This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Bob Kinzel. I know this much about the Singeri family. My grandmother arrived at Ellis Island with her cousin after leaving her native Bratislava, Slovakia. My grandfather was from Prešov, Slovakia, possibly coming to this country through Canada. When tracing a family's ancestry, sometimes even knowing just a tiny bit helps us learn more. For Marcy Harding of Richmond, a mystery in her family started with the Russian Revolution. A few years ago, she and 25 members of her extended family traveled to St. Petersburg on a trip that was part family reunion, part research.
My grandmother had grown up in St. Petersburg and left in 1917 at the age of 17 during the Russian Revolution. During the visit, we had a tour guide who had done a fair amount of research about my grandmother's family based on little bits of information that we had provided. And one of the things that we did during the trip was the tour guide took us to the school that my grandmother had gone to as a young child, and all 25 of us went into the school and sat down in the gymnasium of the school, and the tour guide had gotten a letter from the Hermitage where my great-grandfather had worked when my grandmother was a young child, and this letter talked about his career at the Hermitage. So our tour guide stood in front of this group of 25 of us reading this letter about my great-grandfather's career at the Hermitage in the school that my grandmother had gone to. It was pretty overwhelming to think that we had traced my grandmother's footsteps this far. Because my grandmother left in 1917, she left her family behind. She left alone. She went to France and ended up in the United States, and I might add, enrolled in Cornell University and graduated as the first woman engineer a few years later, and then married my grandfather, who was from the U.S., and ultimately had a family and so forth. But because she had left and left her family behind, she didn't know what had happened to many of her family members, and as a result, her way of coping with that was not to talk about her experiences back in Russia. And so we knew very little of her history, and I think that's one reason that this experience was so overwhelming, was that here we were learning about the life she'd lived, a little bit about it, in St. Petersburg in those early years.
That's Marcy Harding of Richmond, who traveled to Russia to learn more about her family's roots. And travel is a big part of what makes researching family history fun and illuminating for so many people. Today on the show, we're looking at genealogy, why people delve into their family's past, how to go about it, and what resources are available to them in Vermont. Joining me today is Scott Riley, an archivist with the Vermont State Archives, and Ed McGuire of the Vermont Geological Library. Scott, Ed, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick.
Thank you.
Now, Scott, summer is a pretty busy season for you. A lot of people are using their vacation to research family history. So what are people looking for when they come through your doors at the Vermont State Archives?
Well, at the State Archives, we preserve public records, so records of state government. And our records date back to the 1760s, to the very beginning of the state. And when people come to do research, well, one of the purposes of the State Archives is that we preserve records that document the rights of individuals. And those types of records can be a real treasure trove for genealogists. They include things like vital records, so birth, marriage, death, divorce records. They include court records. We have lots and lots of court records. Court records can be fascinating because they give you some insight into controversies that somebody's ancestor may have been involved in. We have probate records, which, again, are prized by genealogists because they contain things like wills. You can find information about descendants. They contain inventories, which can list information about what property people had, when they owned, when they passed, and that type of information really starts to round out a picture of a person's life. You get more information than just who begat who. You start to develop this deeper picture of what a person's life was really like.
How many people do you see on a typical day, and where are they coming from?
Probably on a typical day, we see, you know, three or four people who are just doing genealogical research. Over the course of a month, that's probably 50 or 60 researchers. In addition, we get maybe upwards of 100 requests by mail or email every month from people looking for genealogical information. And we have lots of Vermonters who come and use their state archives to research their family history. We have people coming from all over the country. We have lots of researchers from Canada. We've had researchers as far away as Australia come and do research on their Vermont roots.
And in Middlesex is where people can come, is that correct?
Yep, we're located in Middlesex.
Mm-hmm. And Ed McGuire, you are the president of the Vermont French Canadian Genealogical Society that operates the Vermont Genealogical Library right here in 40th and Allen. What kind of records do people have access to there at your place?
Well, in addition to Vermont vital records that are available in the state archives and other places, we have 4,000 books that deal with history and genealogy and individual family histories. Microfilm, 6 computers on the internet, and we have 4 what we feel are important databases, subscription databases that visitors and members can use for free that will enable someone with Vermont ancestry to trace their folks back to early New England, Quebec, or perhaps New York.
So even though it is the Vermont French Canadian Genealogical Society, it goes beyond just French Canadian, correct?
Yes, we have. As an example, I'm mostly Irish, German, and English. And I don't speak any French. Most of our members don't. But half our members have some French-Canadian background, and the rest of us we have research material on Irish, German, English, Scottish. We have members who are Danish, Swiss, French.
I'm talking to Ed McGuire of the Vermont Genealogical Library and Scott Riley from Vermont State Archives. Listeners, you can join the discussion about genealogy by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can post a comment on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Have you investigated your family's history? What did you discover? Let us know. You can share your stories at 1-800-639-2211. Ed McGuire, do people already need to know a lot about research techniques before they come to your library?
No, not really. One of our focuses is education and assisting people in doing their own research. So most of the people that walk in have only a sketchy idea of perhaps their grandparents. Mm-hmm. And our resources and our volunteers are pretty familiar with how to start the basic research process. And we can help people organize their effort and keep the effort organized as they start to gather more and more paper records.
I would imagine that's a big problem.
Yes.
So, Scott, what if a person knows very little about their family? How do they get started?
I think the best place to get started is to ask your own family. Start with what you do know and then work backwards from there. So talk to family members. You can collect a lot of good information that way first, and then it's really kind of a puzzle. And you're always, as you do genealogical research, you're always building upon what you know or what you've found documented. So you just start by asking people and then start to write it down and build from there.
And then they'll walk into state archives, and where do they go from there?
Basically, when somebody comes in, we try to get a sense of how much they've already found out so far. And from there, we can make recommendations on what resources that we have are going to be most useful to them at that point. Our job as archivists is really to help people find information that's going to be useful to them at that point. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of shepherding people from one resource to another, teaching them a little bit how to use the resources. And most people start with vital records, and then they may move on to probate records, and once they've exhausted that, they may move on to town records and that. So it's constantly, you're sort of exhausting a resource and moving on to the next one to try and find that next piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Ed McGuire, when someone walks into the Vermont Genealogical Library and doesn't know where to start, how do you get them started?
Typically, we'll have someone sit down with essentially a 4-generation chart and start filling in their parents and then in numbered positions, their grandparents, great-grandparents, what they know, mm-hmm. what dates they know, perhaps the locations. And as they begin to work on a family unit, we record the whole family unit, the husband, wife, the children, where the major events came from. And as we start putting that mosaic together, it provides you with places that you obviously want to search further, perhaps a missing marriage or a missing marriage document. And then, as Scott pointed out, you if you exhaust the vital records of marriages, deaths, and births, we look at census records, probate records, town records, church records. We have a large collection of church records at our library, and we often use those to supplant the holes in the very good collection of Vermont vital records. We're really blessed to be in Vermont with its open access to our records, and in New England, where there's a whole history for 400 years of recording these events.
That's fantastic. We did hear from Cheryl, and she wrote to us and said, I started researching my family's history as my father was dying, and I became the default family archivist. Ancestry.com has been a huge help, along with my family's tendency to keep every scrap of paper they deemed important. I have learned that my maternal great-grandfather stowed away on a boat from Germany so that there is no record of him entering the country. I learned that other ancestors have been in the U.S. since before the Revolution and that some owned slaves in Maryland. That was rather sobering. And right now Cheryl is saying that her ultimate goal is to put together a book for her nieces and nephews. Do you find that kind of thing, Scott, when people come in that they kind of start for some reason, maybe a death in the family, and it leads to something even bigger?
It really does. It's some of the most powerful stories that we see. Researchers come in and they're researching the very recent past. I think as Marcy talked about, her grandmother didn't talk about her background, but you know, Marcy went and they started to do their own research. We have researchers who come in whose parents, for one reason or another, refuse to talk about their past. And it's the children who want to learn, who come in and start to do the research. And they start finding those threads and pulling the threads and sort of weaving that tapestry of the family history. And it's there's no telling what you'll find as you start to go backwards.
Ed McGuire, how gratifying is it when you have someone come in and all of a sudden this history starts to unfold before them?
Oh, it's really nice to sit there and watch their eyes open, and they get excited. And the minutes and hours just fly by for them, and oh my goodness, you have to close now? You get the impression they'd be there at 2 in the morning if they could. And it's the one of the interesting things about genealogy is if you like solving puzzles, the hunt, the difficulty of finding a particular record just whets your appetite to find a way around it.
Oh, that's fabulous. You can join the discussion today on genealogy by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And let's talk to Phyllis in Middlebury. Phyllis, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's on your mind?
I would like to call the listeners' attention to business as opposed to people. And in Addison County, we have Hamilton Beer's Atlas, and it is called the Addison County Gazetteer and Directory, as I said, 1881, and it's just a treasure.
That's
and
fabulous.
I expect that all the libraries in the county have that book.
And Phyllis, what is in it that you have found so fascinating?
Well, I'm French-Canadian by descent, but I've lived in Middlebury for 80 years, and I find the advertisements by the various businesses to be extremely interesting, as well as the diagrams that go along with them, for instance, the horse and carriage.
Oh, that's fabulous. Phyllis, thanks so much for calling. Scott Riley, the Gazetteer, is this something that we would find at your state archives, but also in libraries throughout the state? And what would people research these for?
Yeah, absolutely. Child's Gazetteers, they did one for, I believe, every county. And if you're researching in the late 19th century, they function, they include part town history, they're a business directory, they're a terrific resource if you're researching family members during that time period.
I'm Rick Singeri in for Bob Kinzel. This is Vermont Edition. No matter what you know about your family's past, you are the product of countless generations of ancestors. And as we're learning today, there is plenty of information available nearby that could help you connect to that past. Helping us on our quest is Ed McGuire of the Vermont Genealogical Library and Scott Riley. He's an archivist with the Vermont State Archives. But now we'll talk to a person who turned her genealogical research into a novel depicting some of her family's history. Joining us is Cassie Horner of Woodstock. Cassie, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much.
Now, your novel is Lucy E. Road to Victory. Lucy was your great-great-grandmother's sister. How did you get interested in Lucy E.?
Well, I was researching collateral lines, and I discovered that Lucy, who was born in the 1820s in Vermont, had had five husbands, which really kind of shocked me because it didn't seem to match up with anything else I knew about my family. So I did more research, and I discovered that her second husband was a Civil War veteran who turned out to be he was a really bad man. He was an arsonist, and he was a gambler. He abused her. I mean, he had a really bad history, and he ended up in the Concord, New Hampshire prison for 10 years.
But this woman really made something of herself, correct?
She did. She did. I really delved in a lot of deeds. Deeds were a really good source of information. And she and her husband were, her first husband were in the poorhouse in New Hampshire. But suddenly she owned land, and it was what was amazing for that time period was that it was in her name. It was not in her husband's name at a time when, you know, men really owned whatever their wives owned. So I did a lot of research to find out how she made that jump and found the answer in a deed that she actually traded one of her husbands. She traded a horse for their first piece of land. So she was really a fighter. She was smart. She could read and write. And so she really captured my imagination.
Well, you researched her life for 6 years. When did you decide that writing a novel was the right way to present this research?
Well, I had tried to write it as nonfiction, but I just kept coming up to a dead end. It just didn't really work for me. And I was talking to Howard Coffin, the Vermont Civil War expert, and he said to me, why don't you write a novel? And as soon as I started writing about her, her voice was just so powerful to me that it just almost wrote itself.
And you wrote it in the first person, correct?
Yes, I did.
What does having this intimate knowledge of an ancestor mean to you?
Oh, it helps me better understand myself. It helps me better understand certainly, my grandmother and other relatives, and I think finding a document in her words, it was an affidavit, a court affidavit, where she talked about how her husband had threatened to kill her and what she had done to try and keep things going. I mean, I just felt it took days for me to kind of take that information in, and I felt like I had this much broader sense of who I was and who I came from in New England.
Wow. Cassie Horner of Woodstock is the author of Lucy E. Road to Victory. It's an outgrowth of her genealogical research. Cassie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We have Ed McGuire of the Vermont Genealogical Library and Scott Riley. He's an archivist with the Vermont State Archives with us today. And Scott, who are these people who come to your place and who are digging through the records? Amateurs, pros, who are they?
We see people of all stripes, people who are very seasoned researchers, some people who are actually professional genealogists who you can make your living doing genealogical research.
Oh, my.
But I would say most folks are amateurs and varying levels of experience.
Mm-hmm. And Ed, any odd requests that you get when people come to the Vermont Genealogical Library?
Well, everybody's got their own set of goals. And sometimes if you start from a position where you're not familiar with doing research, the request can become can seem a little outlandish to somebody who realizes how much work is involved in most cases to do research. Occasionally you do forensic-type genealogy where you're looking for survivors of a family, where they're trying to determine whether a cousin or a son or a grandson has any remaining survivors. And But generally, it's the standard. I want to know more about my family. Yeah. I'm interested in this, you know, batty uncle.
We're discussing genealogy today on Vermont Edition. You can join the discussion at 1-800-639-2211. And right now we have John from Waitsfield on the line. John, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
It's more of a comment. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for this segment. I come from New York City, but I'm working in Waitsfield for the summer. I'm what I call an Ellis Island mutt. My great-grandparents came over in the 19-teens, and before that, it's hard to trace back into the old country, Italy, Russia, to small cities that might not exist. So it's sort of a word in praise of genealogy. I have friends who are 17th-century, you know, American Mayflower families, and they don't really value the fact that they can trace their genealogy here. So it's one of those things where be grateful that you're able to do it, because there are whole armies of Americans who are unable to do that. And so we kind of get a thrill from this type of genealogy, knowing that there's a diary of a 19th century ancestor or a Revolutionary War uniform in an attic somewhere of the 18th century. So it's exciting to hear this, and value what you have, because many Americans, their legacy administratively stops in 1915 when they came over and got a badge in this new country. So I love the work that's getting done here. Thank
John, you. Great advice, and I saw two heads nodding as you were giving that advice.
Well,
thanks
said.
So much. And let's hear from Kim now. She's in Essex Junction. Kim, thanks for joining the conversation.
Hi, this is Kim. Couldn't hear you quite. I'm a second-generation Franco-American bilingual, and I'm working on a book right now on French-Canadians or Franco-Americans in Vermont, entitled By Way of Canada. And my mother, Claire Chase, spent many years volunteering at the Genealogical Society translating for people, because she also maintained her language. And my question is, as I'm researching, one of my first questions to people that I've been interviewing is, which are Francos, do you believe that you have Native American heritage as well? Because that was very much part of the oral history of my family, that we, you know, not too far back, we had, you know, we were French Indian, and so a lot of us identify as French Indian. So I'm just wondering, it is difficult to find those records for various reasons, you know, just kind of general racism against Native Americans. So my question is, do you find that people are saying, you know, I heard that my grandmother was Native American and I can't find the record, and that's a difficulty that people encounter?
Ed McGuire, can you answer that?
Yes, that's a pretty common occurrence. Many people come in with, especially if they have early New England roots, especially along the border, they have heard in their family that there's the possibility of a Native American ancestor. And it is difficult to sometimes establish, because the records are, if they exist, the tribe itself may not want to share the records with the general public, so you have to go through a few procedures to try to get access to them. Probably before you do that, you might want to take a DNA test to establish whether in your family's genetic footprint there is a Native American set of traits that, and that can save you a whole bunch of effort when perhaps the story isn't true.
Mm-hmm. And Scott Riley, is there anything in state archives that can help someone in this situation?
One of the sets of records that we have came from the Eugenics Survey of Vermont,
oh, yeah,
which was an organization active in the 20s and 30s. And one of the things that the Eugenics Survey was looking at were so-called degenerate traits to try and explain some of the social ills. But in the course of their work, they developed these massive pedigree charts of families. And some of the families that they targeted as part of that program were Abenaki. So we've actually had Abenaki researchers come in and use those records to trace family history.
Wow, that's fantastic. And Ed?
Well, those records also have quite a bit of information on some of the French-Canadian families at that time also. And I'd also like to say that we try to provide the assistance with volunteers, and Claire Chase was a wonderful volunteer for us for decades.
Oh, that's great to hear. We're tracing our family's ancestry today on Vermont Edition. You can join this discussion at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And let's hear from Bill in South Burlington. Bill, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Hi, and I hope this question doesn't sound too obvious, but not specifically for my heritage here in Vermont. My dad was raised around Albany, but both my parents were World War II veterans, and I'm wondering, I mean, beyond the obvious thing about just sort of contacting the Department of the Army, what's an efficient way to find out about their military service record? And I should say, I'm, you know, kind of the last one left. I'm getting old now, and I don't really have access to any family records or remaining relatives or anything like that.
Ed McGuire?
Well, World War II is a little problematic in the sense that there were some fires, I think, like 1973 in St. Louis, where most of the records were kept. However, certainly going through the government is an important path to take. There are few records of World War II on Fold3.com. That's a subscription database, however. And you also might try a professional genealogist to do a quick search. It wouldn't cost you too much to have someone do a quick search of all the possible avenues for records of World War II.
Scott Riley, what kind of military records are available at the State Archives?
For the World War II era, most of those records, if they still exist, were kept at the federal level. Mm-hmm. As you go back farther in time, you find more and more military records at the state level, but in the more modern era, you find those types of records at the federal level with the National Archives.
Scott, have you witnessed any great moments of discovery at the State Archives when someone comes in and starts their search?
Oh, there's so many and different types. I think my favorite are some of the when people come across black sheep in their family. We recently acquired the registers of the Vermont State Prison in Windsor, and those date back to 1809. So people use those quite a bit, and they uncover some of their more colorful ancestors. And
so I guess we always don't uncover happy stories. You know, we're kind of thinking about that. Is that difficult, though, when somebody finds something that is a little less than what they expected or maybe more than what they expected?
I think as you go farther back in time, it becomes, I think, easier to take for some people. If it's in the recent past, I think it becomes closer. It becomes more personal. I think people relate to it a little bit more. But I think the farther back in time, if you maybe found pirates in your family or something, and you'd probably think it was cool,
right?
you know, if your father was in jail for petty theft or something, you probably wouldn't celebrate that so much. But
absolutely. Ed McGuire, how about you? Aha moments where you're watching someone come in, start to research, and they're putting the pieces together and learning about their family's past.
I'd say the one that sticks out in my mind was in the spring and fall, we teach every Saturday. We teach classes in the morning. And one woman she was a relatively new member, and she came out of maybe the third or fourth week of having attended them. And she called me aside and said, "I just want to thank you guys for having the classes because I used your advice, and I never knew who my father was. And I finally figured out who he was. He's living in Florida, and I'm going down next week to meet him."
Oh, my goodness.
That's an aha moment for me.
That is an aha moment. That's fabulous. When someone reaches a dead end or goes down a blind alley, are there people available who might be able to provide guidance, help them move along? What kind of things do you provide there, Ed?
Typically, most of our volunteers have been doing research for a number of years or decades, and we all run into what we call brick walls. The problems that there is no birth record, there's no baptism, you can't find them in the census. And that's when you begin to follow, as one of the people that called in said, collateral lines. You begin to back up and say, let me understand the history of the time they lived in, the location, because maybe I'm looking at the wrong boundary. And let me go back and look at the uncles and cousins and aunts, go back a generation or two, come back forward and look again.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about genealogy today on Vermont Edition. You can join the discussion at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Scott Riley of the Vermont State Archives, I think you've done some looking into your own family. How's that gone? What have you found?
Oh, it's amazing. My father's done most of my family, but I've got to work on my wife's genealogy, and for one, explain some things.
in a very positive way.
All good things, because she comes from tough pioneer stock, which explains she puts up with me quite well. but it really, I think genealogy, one of the side benefits is you get to learn about different times and places that you probably wouldn't have learned about on your own. Her family actually comes from the Northwest, and they're involved in the timber industry. So you find out about these little towns in Washington State, like Enumclaw or Nanaimo, British Columbia, where there are coal mines. So you learn a little bit about these different places and in different times, and it's fascinating.
Have you traveled up there yet to do some research?
Yeah, she still has family out there. We go out to visit, and I think the travel aspect is genealogy is a great excuse to go travel.
Right.
And we see that in Vermont with the people who come here to do research.
Ed McGuire, how about your own research? What have you found?
Well, I'm a Flylander from Connecticut, so when I came up here having 1/8 French-Canadian ancestors and finding this society that people founded about almost 20 years ago, I was able to go after the French-Canadian portion of my family, and once you cross the border, the records are outstanding, and able to go back, in essence, 9 generations in a couple of days of research. And to me, that was, compared to my Irish research, which typically, usually it ends about 1820 in Ireland, if you can get back there to Ireland, you're able to go back to people who were walking the turf with Samuel de Champlain, in many cases go back to the village in France they came from, and in similar cases with England and Germany.
That's fabulous. Now, Ed, you did mention classes that your organization, the Vermont French Canadian Genealogical Society, has. Tell us about some of those classes you offer.
Well, each fall and spring, we run roughly 10 or 12 classes, and they run the gamut from techniques to ethnic groups, et cetera. We start with an open house on the 7th of September, which anybody can drop in and research and see demos. But then we talk about Acadian research, how to organize all the paper records that you have. We bring in outside speakers on how to research the Civil War, the War of 1812, how to do DNA research, how to use Google, Ancestry.com. Various other databases, just the tools, techniques, and processes you use to pursue your family.
Mm-hmm. And Scott, how much faith should one put in the information that they uncover? Is there a certain amount of skepticism that they should have as they start to find these records and find this information?
We always recommend that always consider your sources. At the State Archives, we have government sources, which are generally considered to be trustworthy. Unless maybe you're dealing with tax returns, but generally government records are trustworthy. Always consider, as you go back through diaries and family letters, you're always sort of weighing evidence. So that's just something to keep in mind as you go back.
Excellent. We have time for one more call. Let's talk to Barbara in Windsor. Barbara, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment today?
I have a question. I'm the archivist for the Windsor Historical Society, so I do a lot of research, and I used the family search with the Mormons for many years, and now it has changed, and I was wondering whether you men use that site also.
All right. Let's check first with Ed McGuire. Ed, do you use the site, and has it changed in any ways recently that are pretty important for people to know?
Yes. The Family History Library in Salt Lake City put the site online years ago so you could look up what microfilm you might order at your local family history center at a Church of the Latter-day Saints, like in Essex Center. And they've started to develop a website, and they've digitized more and more information such that it's a real rival to the powerhouses that are out there, like Ancestry and World Vital Records. It's free, has a great learning center, which is also free. And the records are outstanding, and their original records, the primary records from all over Europe, Asia, South America, and North America. And those are the records, as Scott mentioned, that when you can go back to a primary record, you're much better off.
And Scott, have you had success with these as well?
Yes, I think databases like FamilySearch or Ancestry.com, I think that's one of the reasons I think genealogy is going through sort of a boom period where there's so much more interest because it makes it so much easier for people to research. Not everything is digitized at this point, so.
There's still room to get that all taken care of.
Yep.
Scott Riley is an archivist with the Vermont State Archives, and Ed McGuire is with the Vermont Genealogical Library. Thanks, gentlemen, for joining us today.
Thank you.
And just ahead, we'll have a look at destructive apartment fires around Vermont and the prevention efforts that may help stop fires in the future. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Zingari, in for Bob Kinzel. This week, VPR News has been exploring the problem of fires, particularly fires that have destroyed apartment buildings in Vermont's downtowns and village centers. VPR's Charlotte Albright has been reporting on the causes and fire prevention strategies that have worked well in some towns. She joins us now to explain more. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you.
Now, there's no shortage of examples of the kind of fires you've been reporting on. There were large destructive fires in Springfield, St. Johnsbury, Enosburg, and Brattleboro, to name a few. What impact does it have on a town when a major block of downtown is destroyed by fire?
Well, first of all, we're talking about injuries and deaths. I mean, just since 2000 in St. Johnsbury, there have been 6 fire deaths. And in other fires, the tenants were safely evacuated, but you know, they lose their homes and they lose all their possessions. So here's Bob Wilkins. He is recalling his dramatic rescue in St. Johnsbury in 2009.
They, in very slow motion, took a ladder off the truck and eased it up to me, and I'm on the third floor. And they climbed up and broke the window and got me out of there.
You can really hear sort of the painful memory in that voice. He was pretty hard to track down because a lot of these people do really disappear. He was lucky enough to get other housing across the street, but the Red Cross generally puts people like Bob up in hotels and motels, and that can be expensive. And it's disruptive for them. And as I say, it's hard to know how many become homeless because the state doesn't track that. Now, as for the downtowns, a big fire can leave a big scar. You know, serious damage can hurt local businesses who were burned out, or maybe water damage. Sometimes they lose customers because the block is so unsightly for months or years. But in other cases, and we went to Springfield to see this, public housing trusts can step in and rehab the buildings to be better than they were before. So here's Springfield Housing Director Bill Morlock. He's talking about how risky it was rebuilding the burned-out Ellis Block, which included a movie theater.
And I think we're going to hopefully be proved right that it did, you know, it's doing well enough so that it has helped downtown.
Of course, the jury's still out on that.
Charlotte, you learned that inspection is a key here, both the training of inspectors and the hiring of enough of them to cover the state.
Well, that's right. The state employs 32 inspectors. That may seem like a lot, but they've got to make 17,000 visits a year to public buildings, and that's not all the buildings at all. In Vermont, there are at least 40,000 rental units subject to inspection. Increasingly, the state, then, is delegating inspections to municipalities. But in those rural areas, inspectors can be health officers, and they're well-meaning, but they're not necessarily trained in fire safety. We also went to Burlington because there, records showed that inspections by municipal code enforcers were more thorough at times and somewhat more frequent than those that the state inspectors had time to do. So here's Burlington Inspector Bill Ward. He's stressing how a whole community needs to place a priority on fire safety.
We cannot do this unless we have the cooperation of the landlords and the property owners and property maintenance workers who work with us to make the unit safe.
Now, we searched state records, and we found out that many of the large buildings outside of Burlington, that were destroyed by fire in, say, the last decade, had not been inspected by the state for several years prior to the fire. That's not because the state is negligent, but they have a lot to do, and they have to put a priority on new buildings because otherwise they would be holding up construction. So that's kind of a dilemma.
Often these are apartment fires, and the renters who live there are the ones displaced. How does responsibility for prevention get shared between tenants and their landlords?
Well, to be honest, Rick, sometimes that kind of falls through the cracks, because the landlords told us that it was difficult to force their tenants to maintain their smoke detectors, and also it was hard for the landlords to keep track of changing fire codes. So we talked to Jerry Boardman. He owned the building that burned in St. Johnsbury in 2009, and here's what he had to say.
You know, when I first started the store, yeah, you had to have a smoke detector maybe. But by the time we had the fire, you had to have smoke detectors, they had to be hot-wired in, and they had to have the battery back up.
So he's saying that the rules kept changing. But advocates would like to see more than just smoke detectors. The director of fire safety for Vermont told us that the best way to prevent damage and loss of life is to install a sprinkler system. Even in private residences, that makes a difference. But the state of Vermont does not require sprinklers. Property owners say they can be too expensive. There are other states, though, that do require them in all public buildings and even in new private residences.
So, Charlotte, beyond requiring sprinklers, what other policies or regulations would help the situation?
Well, some of those sprinkler requirements are sort of happening. Montpelier, for example, is now requiring that all new residences are equipped with sprinklers. But obviously that means that, you know, you might be safer in a Montpelier building than you are in some other town. Senator Patrick Leahy has just proposed federal legislation that would grant tax credits of up to $50,000 to property owners of multi-use buildings in historic districts for the installation of sprinklers. Vermont is already competitively awarding tax credits to owners of buildings like that. In late July, Governor Peter Shumlin announced nearly $2 million in those credits, but the program routinely receives many more requests for tax credits than the state can afford to allocate.
We've been stunned by several large downtown fires, as you've mentioned, but is it all bad news?
Well, you know what? There's progress. Burlington's strict regulations do seem to be making a difference. And the number of annual inspections statewide has been rising. Nationally, fire death rates are declining, and Vermont is no exception to that encouraging trend. So, yes, there is some good news.
That's great. VPR Charlotte Albright has been reporting on apartment fires for the news project Burned Out. You can learn and explore more online at vpr.net. Thanks, Charlotte.
You are very welcome.
This week in the news, Vermont lost an appeal in federal court, with judges telling the state that lawmakers tried to interfere with nuclear safety. Also, organic growers cried foul over taxing compost. A sex offender's release from prison prompted new debate over the idea of civil commitment. The health department says it's paying attention to schools that have low vaccination rates, and state tax revenues show that consumer confidence is growing modestly. These were some of the voices in the news this week.
If you keep nuclear safety issues completely out of the consideration, out of the record, out of any way, shape, or form the basis for your decision, you're okay. If you stick to economics, you stick to need, you stick to other environmental impacts, you build a record, you make a decision on those grounds, you're free to decide the fate of Vermont Yankee.
The possibility of taxing compost while other agricultural inputs, including chemical fertilizers, are not taxed, feels very much like conventional agriculture is being incentivized while organic agriculture is being penalized.
Those parents who make the decision not to be vaccinated and to fill out that philosophical exemption is even higher. And that's an area where we can focus some of our efforts on that population and those parents.
Likely to reoffend means they likely will reoffend. And that is a terrifying prospect, especially when an individual lives within 1.5 miles of our schools.
I would never want to see us in this state locking people up preventively. It makes no sense whatsoever.
People are still going out to dinner. They're comfortable enough to go back out to dinner, but maybe they're still a little conservative with going out and buying bigger ticket items.
VPR's reporting on these stories and more is online at vpr.net. That's our program for today. I'm Rick Singeri.
And I'm Jane Lindholm. The start of the school year is just days away, and Monday on the program, we'll look at the achievement gap among kids from different socioeconomic backgrounds, and at how poverty can be a difficult barrier to educational success. Join us for that discussion on Monday, and send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. Have a great weekend.